to our latest seminar on how to turn your book into a bestseller, how to create your book from scratch, how to do it in a weekend. And we have the guy who's done it all. And I am proud to introduce you to Adam Homey. Adam and I have been working together for more than a decade. He reminded me the other day that it's been about 12 years since he started out as my webmaster, but he has grown and morphed and worked with a lot of big names in the industry, and now he works and does a lot of marketing work, and he has just written his new book, which I will let him tell you about, Groundhog's Day, which is a great title, and don't remember the subtitle. So, Adam, what's the subtitle? Tell us about your book.
Groundhog Day is an event, not a business strategy. So basically what this book is about is it deals with issues that small businesses face where it's like, didn't we talk about this yesterday? And why do we seem to have these same problems year after year after year? One of the things that inspired it is if you go on social media right around the holiday season, and come on, Sandra, get out of the way here. One thing guys are going to, folks are going to get used to is the fact that my cats are my personal assistants and they do earn their keep, but I'll try and keep them out of the camera's lens as much as possible. So what we discover is, especially around the holidays, people make their best year ever declarations. This is going to be my best year ever. And then when you go back and you look at those declarations and some of the specifics, like their revenue goals and their not only their revenue goals, but also like what they plan to do. They're going to get new clients. They're going to start a new business. They're going to start new lines of service. And you track them from year to year. It seems like they keep making the same declarations, but at the end of the year, they end up in the same place, sort of like that movie Groundhog Day, over and over and over and over again. So in one sentence, what we do is we look at some of the little things that are burrowed beneath the surface of your business and help raise those up so that you can grow the greener grass on your side of the fence.
Great, great. And I want to compliment you on your cats. You know, some people might think it's a distraction, but frankly, I think we can all agree that the purpose of a business is to give you freedom and live the life that you want. And I admire you for having the life that you want and having time with your cats, and I'm sure everyone else is equally envious and wishes they had more time with their family and their pets and their hobbies as well. So that's the definition of a true entrepreneur as I see it, and I'm glad that you are the embodiment of it. So you wrote your book in a record amount of time. In fact, when you had your webinar yesterday, we talked about how to write books fast, and there are In my book, I mentioned there are five different kinds of books, actually. There are books you could write in a weekend. You could write a book in an hour, frankly. You could take your famous quotes that you have, and turn it into a 120-page book, and a lot of people have done that. You could take other people's quotes and turn that into a book, and other people have done that, too.
True.
If you go up the ladder toward thought leadership, and by the way, those are good products to have. They sell from the back of the room. You are an author. It's good. It's a good way to get your foot started. But you didn't write one of those little quote books. You actually wrote a book that has, I don't know, 250 pages or so. I mean, hold it up again. Hold it on the side. It's a thick book there. And turn on the side. Yeah, but it's not so thick that you can't, I find you can turn people off if you write a 400-page book. I mean, people don't want to read an encyclopedia. They want to get on a plane in New York, and by the time they get to LA, they want to be done with the book. And you've pretty much done that. It's a very readable book. There's white space. Yep. There are call outs, there are quotes, there are lists, everything that I tell people to do in my book, write your book in a flash. So tell us, you told me that you pre-wrote your book. So even before you had decided to write a book, much less what the topic would be, but that, and a lot of people who ask questions, frankly, said, how do I get started? So why don't you explain the whole process of how you got started writing your book?
Dan, you mentioned a while ago that I originally started with you, and this was back in 2006. You and I met at an NSA seminar in, I believe, January, February of 2006. I remember it was held in Washington, D.C., and there was a big blizzard coming in on the day we were all supposed to leave. We almost ended up hanging out there an extra 3 days. So I remember it very well. And you and I started working together shortly after that. We've been together ever since, so it's been a little over 12 years at this point. And I started with basically assisting you with keeping the PR Leads website running. And what's been very exciting working with you over the past several years are some of the things we've done together and some of the things that you've initiated, such as the Guaranteed Press Release Service, when we did the Media Publicity and Thought Leadership Program back in 2014. And now it's very exciting to see you launching Write Your Book in a Flash. The evolution has been so exciting. You've done a couple other books in the meantime as well, including Internet Marketing Confidential and Reporters Are Looking for You. So those are two books you've come out with just in the time that you and I have been together, which shows what a prolific author you are. So as I've evolved as an entrepreneur myself...
Model, right?
Yeah. As I've evolved as an entrepreneur myself, I went through a period for a couple years where, to put it in one sentence, I was deciding, well, what do I want to be when I grow up? It's like, I don't really want to be a web guy, and I don't want to be yet another marketing guy. I want some differentiation, and there's some things that I had wanted to do in business for a long time that just sort of never came up with the opportunities that arrived on my plate, but I couldn't define what those were. But I did know that I had a lot of gears grinding in my mind, you know, from Family Guy when Peter says, you know what grinds my gears? So I started a blog. It's called The Morning Adam. I don't believe I posted to it in a couple months, but I used to post to this thing once, sometimes twice, sometimes three times a day. I had this backlog of things that I just wanted to rant about, wanted to share about, stories I wanted to tell. And I made the decision I was going to put up a blog. I was going to put out all these different stories, and I was going to see what developed. There was no specific conversion goal. There was no specific avatar. I was just going to speak to the marketplace and see what turned up. Committing to do it for 3 months, and then go back and look at some of the trends, some of the topics, some of the storylines that emerged over time. And those actually formed the basis of what became Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy, because I noticed the biggest trend where all the little things that sometimes we don't even see consciously that slow us down, stop us, or get in our way as we strive toward our ultimate success as thought leaders, authors, speakers, and entrepreneurs. So by pre-writing it, that's kind of what I mean by that. When I decided... right after the Christmas holiday in the year 2016, right before New Year's there, I went and I spent a day actually outlining a book. And we'll talk about that a little bit more because I used one of your formulas that you'd already shared with me by that time. And I didn't have a story frame for it yet. The idea of calling it Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy came up a little bit later. But at that point, I was able to go back and look at this backlog of articles and stories and form them into a whole. So that's what I mean by I pre-wrote the book even before I knew for sure what it was going to be about. I needed to decide what I wanted to be when I grew up, so to speak, and I just started writing and allowed myself to follow the path as it took me naturally, and then I went back and looked at the trends, and that revealed a lot of answers for me.
Great. So a number of people have asked, how do you get started? So that certainly is one strategy. I'm wondering, when you were writing those daily blogs, The Morning Adams, did you use all of them, or did you selectively cut and use ones that, how do you decide what to keep?
Okay. We're going to be jumping ahead here a little bit, but I want to highlight right now a thought, like one of the concepts from Write Your Book in a Flash. You give... an entire, I'm not sure if it's an entire chapter or at least an entire section of a chapter on how to outline the chapters of your book. And one of the points that you make is to prove your points with describers. And describers, I'm going to look at my screen here and I'm going to read your definition, Dan. Describers is a mnemonic device I created to make it easy for you to brainstorm and identify information for each chapter. So each letter in describers stands for a word. So like the word describers, diagrams, engaging members, stories, cartoons, relevant quote, incidents and anecdotes, bar charts and graphs, every relevant question, research, and studies and case studies. So I created a describer for Groundhog Day as an Event, Not a Business Strategy. It's called the SPRING formula, S-P-R-I-N-G. Science of the mindset, prospect attraction, ripple effect from team members and how to avoid it, identify and intake new customers, Name Your Terms with Powerful Language and Greater Efficiency and Service Through Minimalism, S-P-R-I-N-G. Once I identified my describer, I went through my collection of articles, not only from the Morning Adam, but from some other blogs, and even from the manuscript of another book that I'd worked on a couple years ago and just decided not to publish because it had some great content and I decided not to go ahead with that particular book. Brought all those things together, and I decided which ones fit under S, which ones fit under P, which ones fit under R, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, after I got those organized under the S-P-R-I-N-G, I went through the manuscript a number of different times, and you know, throughout the articles, I found, okay, well, this thing I'm mentioning now, this kind of relates back to what I said back in chapter 2, so I'm going to make a reference back to that.
Got it. And I love the fact you bring up the spring method. That's actually a strategy I used with one of my coaching clients. She was writing a self-help book, and it was talking about the five mindsets. And what you're talking about there really is a generic, you know, geez, that Don Miguel Ruiz, that's the four mindsets, or that's the four agreements, right? So,
right.
It wasn't branded. And you bring up a very important point here in creating your own system, giving it a name and making it your own so you can go out and really own it. And in line with that, I suggested that she create the Amber method, which happened to be her first name.
Nice. And
the A would stand for, well, you're going to have to read her book to find out. But mm-hmm. Something that we in the National Speakers Association have been doing for so long in so many ways that it's like second nature to us. But when I told her about it, she was like, really? I can do that? Doesn't that sound kind of vain? Isn't that kind of like self-serving? Like, yes, of course it is. That's the purpose of marketing, to stand out, to have your own system. Everyone is doing this. So thanks for highlighting that important point and telling us a bit about your process.
You know what's funny is that's so true, and sometimes it's as simple as using your own name. I'm reminded that maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I did some consulting with a woman. Her first name was Mia, M-I-A. Mm-hmm. So we came up with Millionaire Insights and Actions, M-I-A, Mia.
Cool. Excellent.
Sometimes it's that simple.
Yeah, it is. You know, those people who have X's and Z's in your name, well, sorry about that. Okay. Adam, you know, see, to write a book this quickly, you really have to be in a certain frame of mind. You know, how did you psych yourself up and how did you, and I'm sure people want to know how you actually blocked out the time, but we'll get to that in a second.
Right.
First of all, the frame of mind, how did you just get into that zone?
All right. Everybody has different motivators. And I know in your book, you talk about the right frame of mind. You deal with imposter syndrome. You deal with how do I find time to do this? All kinds of things that can come up with authors and prospective authors as they're creating their book. For me, I had to make what our mutual friend Jim Palmer would call a just say yes decision. I had outlined this book right around New Year's 2017, as I mentioned earlier. And here we were almost a year later. It was January 2018. Now, I'd created this outline. I'd done a little bit of work on it here and there. I'd worked with some coaches where we actually came up with the idea of calling it Groundhog Day as an event, not a business strategy. And here we were January 10th. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I got two options here because time is just flying by. I can either rename this project, in which case I have to come up with a whole nother storyline and I'm going to lose something that I really want to bring to market because I just love the idea of using the Groundhog Day concept, or I can wait another year because how the heck am I going to get this done by February 2nd, which is Groundhog Day? And then I decide there's option number three. To quote Sir Richard Branson, screw it, let's do it. So I decided that I was going to find a way to get this thing done and have it be an excellent book and put it on the marketplace so that it would launch and be available for sale on February 2nd, 2018. Folks looked at me like I had three heads, but I chose to believe in myself and believe in the project and believe that it could be done. I reflected on the fact that most of the content already existed, at least in raw form, where I could weld that together into a manuscript and then read through it and create transitions. I also realized that I was going to have to take certain shortcuts, and we can talk about those in a little bit. I don't want to give it all away, but we took a few shortcuts, one of which you took me to task on a little bit when we spoke privately about it. And I had to make the decision that, well, done is better than perfect. And even if it's not perfect, I can come up with a very great offering for the marketplace. In fact, I'm going to reveal a piece of it right now, is that I was concerned that there might be the occasional typo. So I'm thinking about, how do I deal with the fact that I might not have time to get five different proofreaders and five different editors to go through this with a fine-tooth comb? What am I going to do about the fact that I may be skimming through this thing 3 months later and say, oh, shoot, I cannot believe that I put six bullet points and then said, now go back to these 5 points, which it turns out actually happened somewhere in the book. So here's what I did. The very first subsection of the first chapter, the S chapter, which, you know, in the spring formula, the S, I wrote about this thing called white line fever, which is that syndrome you get when you drive down a highway and then a half hour later, you don't have any idea how you got as far as you did, but you got there safely. Well, the same thing happens when it comes to proofreading your own work. You're so used to what you think should be on the paper or on the web page that you don't see the typos because your mind sees the correct version. Somebody else may or may not see the typo. So I came up with this subsection that had about 40 different typos in it. And then at the end of it, I said, now go back and count how many typos there are and write to me and tell me which ones you found. And bear in mind, there may be other typos you go through this book. So by teaching a lesson about the power of massive action and moving forward, I created space for myself in advance for this to be a great, but, you know, maybe there's a little typo here and there type book.
Yeah, Alan Weiss goes on the rampage here. He thinks people who look for typos just should basically get a life. So that being said, it's always nice to remove as many of them as you can.
Oh, yeah.
One other key point that you do raise there is that deadlines lead to action.
Yep.
I find that that's really important when I'm working. I know it's important with mastermind groups that I'm part of. You know, you might promise the group that you'll do something, and you don't do anything until like the day before the group meets, and then suddenly
that's true.
You're going all out to make it done. So
that's right.
Those people, whatever gets you going, definitely do. Now, you also mentioned that you made the working manuscript come alive in one writing session. How did you do this? I mean, this is really super, super human. I mean, if people do half of what they're going to be very well off. So you are really a poster child here for the far end of the bell curve. I don't expect people on the call to be as prolific as you, but you definitely stand out as a model for people to emulate. And if they do 80% of what you do, then they'll have the book done in 2.5 weeks.
Well, Dan, let me tell you, you know, you hear these programs out there like write your book in a weekend, get your book done in a weekend. And I know some of the creators, some of those programs. In fact, I've been interviewed by a couple of them over the years, and I have great respect for their systems and what they do. And I've even looked into some of those courses, and I believe I took one of them. And let me tell you, that's a very sound philosophy for creating a book. And that right there is a point I want to make. The difference between writing a book and creating a book. As I said earlier, I had a backlog of years worth of articles and stories that I had collated, and I'd put them into a rough outline using a version of your chapter creation formula. So I already had that going for me. Step one of my process, and I really did do most of this over a weekend. I basically cleared out a Saturday and a Sunday. I went to a place where I could settle in and get comfortable and I could be in my zone. In this case, a little cigar shop not too far from here, which usually isn't all that busy. One of the quieter ones, so I wouldn't have people trying to chat me up all day long. And I was away from my home office. I was away from the internet. I just had what I needed in front of me to do the job. I opened up 6 Word documents and I named them S-P-R-I-N-G. 6 Word documents, S-P-R-I-N-G. Went back to my outline that I'd created a year before, and just went and found those articles over the 3 websites where I knew they were all posted and just pasted them in. And then after I pasted them in, and again, other people may have different views on this, but this is just what worked for me. We're just talking about how I did it, is I went into Microsoft Word and I did all that programming. You know how you make all your chapter heads look a certain way, you make all your subheads look a certain way, you make your text look a certain way by programming the styles. I went ahead and did that for all the chapters. And the reason I did it, even though that seems like, wow, that's like ditch digging grunt work, it's because it forced me to look at my content for a very long time. And the more I noticed things, the more they would jump in my head. And I allowed myself to the space to do another thing that's sort of breaking the rules, which is make edits as I go along. So if I'm programming the subheader for a subsection called All This Over a Damn Glass of Iced Tea, for example, I may be reading this, they say, oh yeah, yeah, this little paragraph right here refers back to this thing that we're talking about in this other chapter. So let me put in a parenthesis note reference to that right now. Little things like that. Or I'd notice that there was a tense error, or I'd notice there was a punctuation error. And I'd just go ahead and do that. And it forced me into my manuscript. So after I got S-P-R-I-N-G all formatted that way, I then glued them into one document and read through it a couple times. And from there, I discovered all the transitions I could create. Let me just give you one example. There's a funny story in here in one of the bonus chapters that's called Success Coach Leaves Voicemail for Cat, Grows Business Exponentially. And it's a real funny story about a success coach that you and I have both had as a client. I'm not going to say the person's name because the agreement I have with them is I can talk about this story all day long as long as I don't mention their name. I had done some technical training for their interns on how to use Infusionsoft. And we had done recorded demos where I broadcast it on Skype and I recorded the Skype session. And to show them how to program the forms for a funnel they were building, I used my cat Stella's email address. Yes, my cats have email address. That's why they voted me world's best cat daddy. Well, anyway, a couple weeks later, I got a voicemail from that same intern leaving a message for Stella offering her a free consult session. Mm-hmm. It was not a joke. So what I did is I wrote back to the intern and I said, I just thought I'd like to show you a picture of Stella who you left a message for. That's my cat. Do you recall this? And she wrote back saying, "Aw, Stella's so cute. And yeah, you know, I kind of thought that might have been your cat, but I wanted to leave a voicemail just to be sure." And the reason I tell that story is because it, and I'll share this with our viewers right now, is it speaks to a mindset. There's a reason why this one particular success coach is somebody who bobs up on the radar screen all the time. They do two things that a majority of business creators, authors, speakers, coaches, consultants, and thought leaders won't do, is they pick up the phone and they make offers. Mm-hmm. Most won't do that. But this one said, you know what? This might actually be the guy's cat, but I'm going to leave a voicemail message just to make absolutely sure. And what's really cool about when I tell this story is sometimes folks come to me and they say, all right, we're in private message now, just between you and me. Who is this person? And in a couple cases where I thought that the person asking me might be a great prospect for that particular success coach, I told him who it was. And I can tell you that coach got at least one new client because of that story. Hmm. So the point behind the story is, you know, if you leave a voicemail for somebody's cat, that just shows you're human. And if you have a good sense of humor about it, it lets people know that, you know, you're fun, you're friendly, you're somebody who understands the world, you're somebody that they might really enjoy investing in because you have the sense of humor, you have the humility, you have the humanity. Now, here's the other reason why I bring that up. There are versions of that article called Success Coach Leaves Voicemail for Cat, Grows Business Exponentially. If you Google that phrase, you'll find the articles posted in a couple other blogs because I've written it, other versions of it in the past. But in the book, I added something. When I get to the part where I said I reached out to the intern, I add in parentheses, remember the part about how we call back using email? Because earlier in the book, I had done a whole rant on how the majority of voicemails never get listened to, much less returned, and how to program your own voicemail for better results, and how to reach out to people to get better results. And one of the points I made is that even if you leave a voicemail, the chances are they're going to respond to you by replying by email, just so they don't have to play phone tag with you. So I thought, okay, well, I mentioned this story back here, and now I'm talking about calling somebody back. So let me add a reference. Remember that thing about how we usually call back by emailing. So I use that as just one example, but as I went through the manuscript, I found many examples where I saw one thing that could refer back to another thing, and it created that consistent whole of the story.
Yeah, well done. And that's a good strategy for writing a book. In fact, when I wrote one of my books, Reporters Are Looking for You,
great,
it was
book.
Really my PR, thank you. It was really my PR leads training series, and a number of people all have our PR lead subscribers, and they did get my 90-day message, 90 days of messages. And I basically took all those messages and put them into different categories like phone pitching or following up or creativity or intuition or grammar, punctuation, style, whatever, and just revised them to fit the format, and it was an easy book to write. When I wrote Your Book in a Flash, a lot of it came out from the top of my head because I'd written 12 books before, so I was giving my best tips on how to write a book. So I wasn't looking at any previous notes or blog posts as you had done, but I had that wealth of experience. So
yep.
For people who are listening on the call, there are those two extremes. And I think I wrote my book in about a month, literally. You did a week, I did a month, but you know, c'est la vie.
Right.
It can be done. So if you know your topic really well, the book can just flow out from you. And I also mentioned in my book that you can actually interview other people and get other sources. And I talk about how to arrange an interview and good interview questions and good interview etiquette so that these sources become your advocates and promoters and help you promote your book as well. So there are all those variations. There's no right way. There's no wrong way. It depends on the book. It depends on you. It depends what you have done previously to make this work, or to your own previous background in history. You may have 20 anecdotes you can just pull out of your back pocket and write them in a weekend. So it all varies. There's no right, there's no wrong. It's what's right for you. So that's great. It also brings up another point that any story you tell has many, many different lessons. And I remember one seminar at the National Speakers Association, the speaker, a guy named Lee, asked on one person to tell a story about his grandmother, you know, any story. So one guy in the audience took the bait and stood up and said, and he told a story about his grandmother. And there was no point. He just said, here's a story about my grandmother. She liked to make cookies for me. And okay. So Lee said, so what's the point of the story? And the guy said, I don't know. There is a point to the story. Just my grandmother and she liked to make cookies, and I like to eat cookies. And Lee pointed to a woman in the front row and said, what's the point of this story? And the woman said, the grandmother loved him and took time out of her busy day to make cookies for him. He said, that's the point of the story, that the grandmother showed her love through cooking. Then he pointed to another person in the audience, and he said, what was the point of the story? The point of the story, and then this other guy said, well, the point of the story is that he likes to eat cookies. And of all the things he likes to eat cookies, his grandmother's cookies are the best cookies in the world. He said, true. And he called on 5 or 6 more people, and everyone had a different interpretation of the story, and everyone was correct. No one was more correct than anyone else. And this guy who told the story said, I didn't realize that this story was so deeply layered. And it's true. You can look at your stories and make almost any point you want to make from it. It's an amazing, liberating thing. I'm very intuitive. I can see these things. I deal with a lot of people who are not intuitive at all. They're very cut and dried. And it's like, she makes cookies. That's just it. He eats cookies. She makes cookies. There is no point. No. Between those two extremes, there is a lot you can do. And if you don't have that ability, that's why you need to work with a book coach and a developmental editor who can see what you don't see and point out things that enrich your story and your book. Now, inside your book, there are some features you added that help the reader skim quickly for the main lessons and find information they need right away. And that's so important in today's society with, you know, social media and tweets, and people just have very short attention spans these days. I noticed your book was very fast reading, even though there were, you know, 300 pages. Can you share how you made the book more accessible to everyone?
Okay, a couple things. First of all, if you see me holding it up, you'll notice my fonts are slightly bigger than some other books out there, because I wrote this thing with digital literacy in mind. Whether you're reading the Kindle version or whether you're reading the paperback version, the reality is we have become so attuned to reading at the smartphone level on that little small screen with large fonts so that we can follow without straining our eyes, that's how we approach everything, whether we're looking at a desktop, whether we're looking at a laptop, whether we're looking at a tablet, whether we're looking at a paperback book, whether we're looking at a PDF or a printout of the PDF. We're attuned to reading in a model that is optimized for digital literacy. And that means smaller paragraphs, more bullet points, slightly bigger fonts. So although it meant I had a few extra pages, I kept my fonts a little bit bigger. The second item is a table of contents, and I'll hold up page one of the table of contents. Now, my table of contents goes on for about 4 pages, and that's because I did a two-level table of contents. I did my main chapter heads, and then I put in all the sub-chapter headings. The reason I did that is so the people can see, as you go through my descriptor of the SPRING, the spring formula, they can see the components of the S, the P, the R, the I, the N, and the G. And then later on, after they've read the book, if they want to go back and find a particular story, I make it very easy for them to go back and find that story by breaking it up into subchapters where all the subchapters have a name. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing I do is, because my book only has 6 main chapters, plus an introduction, plus a bonus chapter, plus a bonus interview transcript as the end, is it with each chapter, I add a section called Key Lessons from This Section, where I go through in bullet points and I pull out the key lessons that you would have gained from reading that chapter or that part of the spring formula, so that it's very easy to get the gist of what the previous 30 pages were about. And let's say you're going back and you're trying to say, yeah, Adam was talking about this whole thing about being artfully vague and avoiding being too specific so that the listener or the reader can assign their own meaning and decide it's valuable for their own reasons. Just like the example of Lee and the story of the kid and his grandma and the cookies. What you saw happening in the audience was also different members of the audience assigning their own meaning to the story so they can embrace it for their own reasons. So kind of the same thing here.
Excellent. Excellent. Layout is so important these days because people have such short attention spans. In my book, I've broken up my book with charts, with diagrams, with cartoons. I liked your book. The readability was very good. And if you hold up the book again, there might be some pages that have large headlines.
Oh, here's another one. When I like quote conversations between people, because I have stories of people having conversations, or and sometimes I do word for word scripts of things that you say in certain situations, I make them in the larger font like you see here.
Right, and there's bold faced fonts. So it looks like headlines. So very easy to read, and people might be asking about the multi-level index. That is a function of Microsoft Word. You could actually set up 3 levels of headings if you wanted to.
Yeah.
I like that idea that you shared, because I might want to refer back to a story or a page, and this way it's better than an index because I can see exactly what story or what point I wanted to refresh us and remember. So tell us about your ninja trick that you use to kick off your book pre-launch and create the book and chapter introductions all in one quick step.
All right. Those of you who read nonfiction business books know that usually in the introduction chapter, they'll spend about a half of the introduction chapter just explaining, this is what you're going to find in the book. In chapter 1, you'll find this. In chapter 2, you'll find this. Or it might take the form of, this book is divided into 3 sections. In section 1, we do this. In section 2, we do this. In section 3, we do this. I didn't have that part. Also, even though I had my chapters assembled, the S, the P, the R, the I, the N, the G, the storytelling part of the introduction chapter, and the story about groundhog behavior and why we need to study groundhog behavior to understand the business concepts within this book, I was missing half of the introduction and all the intros to all the chapters. But I had assembled a table of contents. So what I did is I pulled up the Microsoft Word document, put it on my desktop screen. I opened up a software called Camtasia that a lot of people have heard of that allows you to do videos of what's going on your computer screen. It's used extensively for trainings and tutorials. And I made about a 14-minute video of myself just walking the viewer through the chapter, the table of contents. I said, this is the S chapter. We're going to talk about this here. This is the P. This is what we're going to talk about here. And here's what I mean by identify and intake new customers. Did you know that even though somebody has given you money or they've signed up for your membership program, they become your client, that's different than them actually becoming your customer? So just because your cash register is rung does not mean you have a customer. There are certain steps you need to take to transform that purchaser or that transaction partner into your eager and enthusiastic customer for life, and we're going to walk you through those in this chapter. See what I just did there? In a very narrative way, I described the point of what that chapter is. I posted this video online. It got a huge, huge number of likes and comments. And what I didn't tell people is that at the same time I posted that video to my Facebook, I also sent it to my transcriber to have it transcribed. And then I used the transcript, edited that into what I need. I not only got that second half of that introduction chapter I needed and all the chapter intros I needed, I ended up with another story or two that I ended up adding to the book right before we went into production. And so what's cool about that is by creating the thing that I needed, I realized that I wasn't going to have time to write all that if I wanted to meet my deadline. I just wasn't catching the inspiration. But if I could just get my record myself talking about my table of contents, I could get what I needed. I thought, you know what? Let's give people a sneak peek, because people love sneak peeks. And it got them real excited about that. And then that showed me who my initial tribe for the launch of this book may very well be. And then I went through that list of people, all those people that liked and all those people that commented, and I compared those to the list of people who liked and commented on other recent posts that I had shared as I went through creating the book. And it became very clear to me who my most likely cheerleaders were going to be for the launch and who the nucleus of the Groundhog community were going to be.
Great. So that pretty much wraps up the first part of the series of questions about how you created, how you got started, how you decided to narrow your topic, which are all questions that people have asked. So it's wonderful that you've customized this seminar to meet the needs of people who've had pre-asked questions.
Sure.
But a number of people, you're welcome. And a number of people are now asking, how did you build your tribe? Something you mentioned before, you might want to mention what a tribe is. How did you build your tribe to support your book launch and achieve number one status for your book in three different countries? So that's a long question. We'll break it up. How did you build your tribe? How did you launch your book? And how did you become number one in three countries?
Okay, first of all, I want everybody watching this, whether you're watching this live or you're watching a replay later, I want you to burn this word into your brain, reciprocity. Very key word, reciprocity. In fact, we talk about that inside the book, Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy, where I explain the power of reciprocity as applied to transactions where people to go buy a car. Now, here's what I mean by reciprocity. By liking or commenting on my statuses and my videos where I was revealing bits and pieces of the book or sharing updates about the progress of getting the book together, they were giving me gifts. So I decided it was time for me to start giving. I formed a Facebook group, not a page, not a profile, but a group, just to be clear on our definitions. And I had my list of people who I felt were the initial tribe, and I invited them. Every single one of them joined almost immediately. So we moved a more protracted conversation about the development of the book inside the group, stuff I didn't necessarily want to share publicly, but I wanted to focus on the group of people I felt were my tribe. And these are the people who started to get the day-by-day, play-by-play of what was going on. So I would post things like, oh, you know, I'm trying to get this darn thing into create space, but it keeps getting errors. And what would happen is people would start saying, yeah, I remember when I did mine. I was having that problem too, and here's how I solved it. And then you would always get that one person to say, Adam, just give me a call. I'll show you. And what was great about that is I got folks in my tribe to assist me in some of the final points of putting this thing together, like how to get into CreateSpace, how to get it into Kindle, how to get your listing on Amazon to match your Amazon author profile that already exists, how to link the two books together since you usually publish the CreateSpace paperback version and the Kindle version separately, how to get those to link together so that all your reviews go into one stream. And what was also great about that is because these folks had expressed interest, because they had joined my group, I was able to give them a huge give, which is, here's my manuscript. You can have it before anybody else. And people went and wrote. I was honored by that. But what I loved more than anything else is when I started to hear from some of the people, some of the initial people in the tribe and some of the people who have joined the group since, which we've recently renamed that group, the Business Creators Forum, to bring it more in line with my overall business line. But that was the original group. We now call it the Business Creators Forum. Is when I hear from people to say, hey, I read this one thing and I have implemented it and this really worked for me. It's helped me get a new customer. And there was also one where somebody said, yeah, you know what? I realized that my voicemail greeting on my voicemail was inviting a lot of crap. So I took the script that you used inside the G chapter on how to reword my voicemail greeting. And I changed it to that, and I've noticed that there's been a big change in the quality of people leaving me voicemails. I've also noticed that more and more people are just emailing me, which I'd prefer anyway. It's like, that's the best part. Because to me, that's really why I wanted to do this, because I'm aware of these many little things that trip up business creators. I've learned some of this stuff the hard way. Some of my clients and friends have learned this the hard way. Anything I can do to make things easier for you, that's why I did this book.
Great, great. Yeah, you talk about reciprocity. In fact, I wrote it down. And I just finished reading Jade Friedman's new book on the business of being a writer. It's a very, very good book, University of Chicago Press. She has a whole chapter devoted to what you call reciprocity. She calls it being part of the literary community. And it comes right down to that famous Yoda quote of, give before you ask. You know, be a resource to other people, and then they will want to turn around and help you. And that's really one great way to build a tribe. And we're not talking about the giant platform of 10,000 people or 20,000 people. We're talking about a handful of people who are just going to rally around you and be your support group there. So let me tell you two things
that relate to that. When you are posting a book onto Amazon, particularly the Kindle version, which allows you to choose multiple categories, one of the tactics is to find some category that does not have a lot of activity, and it's like a subcategory of a subcategory in many cases, so you're going two or three levels down, but it's still very relevant to your book. Groundhog Day is an event, not a business strategy, ranked number one in three countries for Kindle on the category of semantics. Now you may be thinking, this is a business strategy book. I mean, it says business strategy on the title, in the cover. Use the spring formula to unearth the opportunities buried within your business. What does this have to do with semantics? It has a lot to do with semantics because we have an entire chapter on how subtly rewording phrases that we blurt out all the time brings us so much closer to getting the results that we want. It addresses the issue of how sometimes we think our language is helping us, but it's actually getting in our way. Let me give you one quick example. When folks say, don't hesitate, do you recognize that when you say don't hesitate, you're actually daring the person to do what you're offering to do? For example, don't hesitate to call me when you're in town. Basically, what you're saying to the person is, don't call, just do your thing, or don't hesitate to let me know if you have any questions. What that phrase actually means subconsciously is figure it out yourself. Don't bug me. What we do is we change those phrases. So instead of saying, don't hesitate to call if you have any questions, you say, I'm here if you need anything. Instead of, don't hesitate to call when you're in town, say, give me a call when you're in town. So instead of adding this suggestion that we should actually not be doing the thing we're being offered to do, we just change that to an affirmative statement. That right there is semantics. Mm-hmm. Another thing is the difference between saying to somebody, well, Dan, don't you agree that publishing a book is the best way to gain instant credibility in the marketplace? And you could say, no, actually, it's press releases. So there, you don't agree. Now, if I said, I agree, publishing a book is a great way to become established in the marketplace, you could say, yeah, that's true. So are press releases. So it's rather than demanding or challenging your agreement, by simply stating my agreement up front, I create a common ground from which we can grow our conversation and our community. Those are two examples of semantics. So therefore, it was completely appropriate to put this book in the category of semantics. Now, when I did that research, I found out that to hit number one, I'd basically have to sell 14 copies in one day. Goodness gracious, if you can't like get 14 people to buy a Kindle in one day, I mean, come on. I mean, I'm a pretty introverted person, but I know 14 people. it can be done. Now, what was also very curious about when I formed my tribe and I created the group is I was kind of worried that we weren't going to hit the Groundhog Day deadline because I was having some trouble getting things uploaded into Amazon. They were telling me it was going to take 2 to 3 days. They kept having issues with accepting my file when I put it into Kindle. And then I was worried that the listings weren't going to go live on Amazon in time. I'd come up with this big plan B about how we were going to do a Groundhog Day celebration if the book wasn't there. And then lo and behold, everything worked out for me. And the book was fully ready for purchase on February 1st, the day before Groundhog Day. Logged out for the night. Came back an hour later just to see what was going on online. Couple people in my tribe that jumped the gun and already shared the link to my book with their audience, and I was already making sales. Mm-hmm. So what could I do? I went with it. I mean, it wasn't where I was hoping the antlers would spring, but it happened. So I made the most of it, and I just got the ball rolling. I said in the group, you know what? If you want to go ahead and purchase it, go ahead and purchase it now. I'd like if you could wait till morning, but I understand. I'd just like to get this within the 24 hours so we can hit our bestseller. And people understood and respected that and worked with me on it.
Well, thanks for sharing the truth about the Amazon bestseller status. I'm sure a lot of people were surprised to hear that it only took 14 books to turn you into a bestseller.
Well, we sold more than that. I'm just saying when I did the research, I came up with the number 14 using various tools you can use to determine how many books you need to sell.
Oh, okay. I understand. Thanks for that clarification. Can you share with us a little bit more about the under the hood techniques you use to figure out those categories? You don't have to go into a whole lot of detail because we only have like 5 or 6 minutes left, but right. I know people are probably saying, gee, I didn't know about that. How does he figure that out? And I talk about that a little bit in my book as well, but I'd like your techniques too.
Well, my advice to you is to figure that is that's one of the things you need to figure out before you finalize the overreaching story of the book or what the goals of the book are. And this is why it's also a good idea if there are a couple different things somebody can take from the book. They can get business strategy, but there's also lots of semantics involved. So based on that, I selected the category of semantics. One question you can ask yourself is, what else does my book do? Maybe it has an official title. It has an official statement, like a positioning statement like you talk about and write your book in a flash. But ask yourself, what else is in there? What else is the reader going to get? And that may reveal categories that you have not thought about up until now and your competition may not think about at all. So that's one of the things I leave you with is what else does your book do? What else does it offer? Because on the surface, this is a business strategy book. The word business strategy is real big, even though we say Groundhog Day is an event, not a business strategy, we intentionally made the word business strategy big because there's a lot of business strategy in here. I don't talk about semantics on here. I don't talk about rewording things on the cover, but the fact is there's a lot of that in there. So again, ask yourself, what else can somebody get from my book? So when I put it in that category, because you're not going to write a book about groundhogs and put it in a category called cats, because Amazon, if they catch that, they might ban you. I mean, that's silly. But ask yourself what else your book does that's relevant. In my case, even though it's not a book about semantics, there's a lot of semantics in there, so it's completely appropriate to put it in that category.
Totally. So you're saying you can do your research, find out what topics Amazon has, see where you can play, where you can get a foothold. I mean, I'm sure there are people online who have self-help books or sales training books, and we all know those are very, very congested and competitive categories.
Oh,
some books have been there for 20 years as the number one bestseller in that category. So what other one tip would you offer for how to find that hidden category for that where they can dominate as opposed to the major category where they'd be, you know, number 5,700.
Exactly. Part of it is just do competitive research. Find books like yours and see what categories they're in. Because when you go to their listing on Amazon, it'll show you, you know, we're number 5,000 in this category. We're number 3 in that category. And when you see what category that book is placed in, when you do your category selection in Kindle and CreateSpace, look to see what subcategories are beneath that. So you might be going an additional layer down that somebody else has not gone. Sometimes Amazon decides on its own, well, you know, you selected that category, but you also belong here. So they may add other categories in addition to one you selected, which is why it's important to find that niche. I mean, we're talking about riches and niches here. Finding that specific niche that applies to you. And just as a side note, you know, you don't have to be surreptitious or conspiratorial about this. Like, because I ended up having to speak with representatives of Amazon several times during the process of getting this book loaded onto CreateSpace and loaded onto Kindle so it'd be available for sale. And I even said to the one woman, you know, really, I'm hoping that we can work this out so that we can have this thing live on February 2nd, because the title of the book is Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy. And I really want this live on Groundhog Day so I can hit my bestseller. And she said, yep. We're here to create more bestsellers. So they know the game as well as you do. And, you know, they understand that you want to have success. They know you want to have bragging rights because it serves Amazon's platform. If you're going out to the audience saying, buy my book on Amazon, what you're not saying is buy my book on Barnes & Noble, buy my book on Lulu, buy my book on my website.
Yeah.
So it serves them to want you to want to get bestseller on their platform.
Exactly. We'll have time for another question or two. So one question that comes up a lot is, how much did it cost you to publish your book? So you have the Kindle version and you have the print version. Can you give us like little shorthand notes there?
Okay. I'm going to quote approximate numbers. The biggest expense I had, or the biggest investment I had, was the cover design. And I don't want to say the exact number because I don't want to pigeonhole the person who did my cover in case somebody in this call ends up working with them. But I'm going to say under $500 is a pretty good rate for a good cover. And this is somebody who knows what they're doing, because you want somebody who understands that they need to leave a blank box on the back cover. It needs to be exactly this many centimeters in here and this many centimeters in here so that your barcode will fit properly. Another thing you have is you need to get barcodes, and I can't remember if that was 160 or 260. I ended up purchasing a batch of 10 ISBN numbers, actually not barcodes, but ISBN numbers, because I plan to publish more books. So I actually have 10 of those I just bought in advance. Other than that, for me anyway, my expenses were very, very low. I did have a few $100s to my graphic designer because she created some images for my social media properties, did some stuff with the 3D. There's a one-page website, www.thegroundhogbook.com. I may add more pages later, but it's just a good lander for somebody to go to so they can find about the book and where to buy it on Amazon. And if I add other networks later, there may be other buttons, but right now it's just the option to buy it on Amazon. All told, I'm going to guesstimate I might have been out about $1,500. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing, and you and I said we were going to talk about this. You took me to task on this a little bit because I did not hire a professional editor. I made the executive decision under the whole mantra from Sir Richard Branson, screw it, let's do it, that this was going to be a great and awesome book, but not necessarily a perfect book. I knew I had the confidence, I was in the right frame of mind, the right state of mind, that I could create that reaction. Mm-hmm. And I had that intelligence because I had promoted those blogs where these articles already existed, and I already knew what the marketplace thought of them, generally speaking. So I made the executive decision not to hire an editor. You took me to task for that, and you gave me some reasons why I should have hired an editor, mm-hmm. and I agree that you're absolutely right. I just made the decision that I wanted this book out on Groundhog Day 2018. It was up to me that I had let time fly by. I had given myself 2 weeks to hit this deadline, and dagnabbit, my right state of mind was I was going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
next time around, I'm going to hire an editor.
Okay.
Because that will save me time.
Okay, so for about $1,500, you were there. And, of course, the books are on print on demand, so it's not like you have a warehouse or a garage full of books that you paid for. It says people buy them on Amazon. They get printed and shipped mm-hmm. out. So
Let me give you a tip about that. On CreateSpace, mm-hmm. you can order copies of your book at the wholesale rate. I tell Amazon to list this book at $24.95. Sometimes it shows up as $22. Sometimes it shows up as $28. But I tell them to list it at $24.95. Here's the thing. If in CreateSpace, you can order at the wholesale rate. My wholesale rate is, I think, something like $5 or something like that, because mm-hmm. it's just the wholesale rate. It's not the, you know, my royalties and Amazon's overhead and everything else. It's just how much does it cost to print them, and then how much does it cost to ship them. Have a box of books in your closet anyway. I mean, you don't have to have thousands, but keep at least 50 on you at all times. Here's mm-hmm. what happened. I belong to a cigar society here in Las Vegas, a group of cigar aficionados. We go to different cigar shops every week. And there were about 15 members in our group for 1 month. And I said, you know what? I spoke with the president of the club about this. I said, you know what? Would it be all right if I gave everybody in the club a copy of my book? Because in the club, there are entrepreneurs, thought leaders. A couple of them are published authors. One of them's an Amazon bestseller. So some of the people in my club, the club I belong to, either could be my audience mm-hmm. or birds of a feather flock together. They can recommend me to others. It's a good networking opportunity. Plus, it's the guys. I mean, you know, I want to share my success with them. I say, guys, you know, you're my friends. I hang out with you guys every week. Let me give you a copy of my book. So I brought 15 books. I ended up on the spot selling 30 more copies.
Wow.
I had to run back to my office and grab more from my book, from my box, because I had brought like maybe 20 copies, enough to cover the club and a couple extras. So here's the lesson. Keep a box on you anyway, and keep some in your car at all times, because you never know.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So as we wrap up here, I want to let everyone know that my book is coming out this week. So if you'd like a copy of Write Your Book in a Flash, go to Amazon. You can pre-order it now. The Kindle version is all $3.99. I'm not quite sure what my publisher is charging for the print book, but you can bet it will be economical and will save you a lot of time and energy when you write your book. You can also join my Facebook group, which is free. Send me a note or go to Write Your Book in a Flash Facebook group, and you'll see the information there. And if you get lost, just send an email to Dan at PR Leads, and I'll figure out how to make you a member. Also, I am available for private consultations. I'm happy to talk to anyone for 20 minutes to see if there's a book inside you that I can help you with. And if there is, great. And if not, well, you're going to get 20 minutes of great information at no cost. So that's pretty cool. Information about that is available on my website, which is writeyourbookinaflash.com. So those are my housekeeping notes. I'd like to thank Adam Homey for sharing his insights. And why don't you hold up your book again, Adam, and tell people how they can get in touch with you.
All right. I encourage everybody to run over to www.thegroundhogbook.com. And if you want a Kindle version, I usually keep the price on that very low. I think today it's 99 cents. Sometimes it's $2.99. Sometimes it's $3.99. But you can get a very economical Kindle version. Now, if you want to have a 15-minute conversation with me, and I do offer this inside the book, so I'll offer it to you as well, and also because you're Dan Janelle's community, what you do is you go to www.schedulewithadam.com. That's www.schedulewithadam.com, and there's a very simpler scheduler there. You can even type in what you want to chat about, find a mutually convenient time, put yourself in. We're good to go.
Cool. Well, again, I'd like to thank Adam Homey and Stella the Cat for sharing great ideas with us today. And thanks, everyone, for being on the call. If you have any questions, please do get in touch with me at dan@prleads.com. Thanks, and have a great day.